I want to begin by introducing people and then subject, if you will permit me. It is one of the nicest things for me that we get to do in this conference from time to time, that we invite the Debian project leader, who this term, in his first term, is Sam Hartman, elected last year as DPL. I love it when the DPL comes to the conference because people whose businesses work extremely hard to distribute software and get it out the door in clean and reliable condition are always a little bit surprised to discover that a community of people operating under conditions of pure democracy and with minimal hierarchy manages to do that for 53,000 packages or so in several different aged versions every year, all the time, like slow clockwork. Exposing the DPL to this community is, in that sense, a window into what it is that we can do that not everybody even knows that we can do. But both panelists today are expert in that. Sam, who is just another part of MIT's contribution to the world of freedom, began working on Kerberos when Kerberos was young, and has worked on Kerberos throughout, and is therefore responsible for pretty much the only theoretically and practically strong system of high network security for real people to use in the academic and business worlds that anybody ever made. Once again, it's important to point out that we were working on solving problems that people didn't know they had yet, and Sam's technical career has been about that. He has been the chief technologist at MIT's Kerberos Consortium from 2002 to 2008, and was then a member of the security team at the Internet Engineering Task Force as its area director in security, and now operates the largest invisible software company that makes slow and perfect software in the world. Richard Fontana needs less of an introduction in this room, but I just want to say that when you run a teaching practice, which I do, occasionally you run across a lawyer who comes to work for you who needs no teaching. Richard was in that condition when he arrived at Software Freedom Law Center in 2006 to work with me on making GPL 3. I discovered that I had a lawyer whose claim charts were so good that the USPTO would just take them in a re-exam and adopt them wholesale. And a guy who could do what I could not do, which was to keep his temper for 18 months while we made GPL-3. And he kept his temper with me and with RMS and with the world. And it was a massive achievement, which I could not have taught him. Since then, he has been doing at Red Hat a number of different jobs. They call him senior commercial counsel, but
that's because I didn't want IP in my title.
Yeah, well, that was a good choice, but it left out the takes care of Fedora, which is a really important part of this story, because Richard too understands how communities of can I say about Fedora that is non-hierarchical? The hidden hand is the only hierarchy in Fedora, let us put it that way. And Richard has managed both the hidden hand and the beauties of community almost at the same level of complexity that Sam has. I wanted to have a conversation about licensing, but I wanted to have it in a slightly different way than we have typically been having it. We are aware that software that we make and whose rules of distribution we have created collectively together, software that we make is now distributed in two quite different ways, which I call fast and slow in the prospectus for this talk, but which we could also call informal and formal. That is to say, we make distributions that we plan very carefully. And Debian is a very carefully planned distribution, which is upstream from a lot of other carefully planned distributions, which rely upon Debian's accuracy and complexity suppression, and which just take it and modify it and share it, knowing that the infrastructure of software distribution underneath is solid and well considered. And we also make an awful lot of workloads in contemporary enterprise computing, which are containers thrown together rapidly and in various lightly disciplined ways, and which exist for milliseconds before they are gone forever and replaced by another container, which might look very much the same, except is slightly different in ways that nobody is paying much attention to. And we are using the same set of rules, the same principles of sharing and notification of rights and collection of material for legal proof of a freedom to operate and use. And we are using the same rules across that broad spectrum, from the most formal and the most planned and the most slowly matured, make no software release before its time, that we are using for a series of arrangements which are celebrated for their flexibility and ease of multiplication and all of the properties of the modern cloud. It may be that our rules work perfectly across that entire large domain, or perhaps they don't. Perhaps one of the issues we should be thinking about with respect to licensing is how broad the span of distribution styles now is. And that's the conversation that I hope that we can have. But I want to begin by the place I always begin with the DPL. So Sam, tell them what we do and how we do it.
So hi, my name is Sam Hartman, and it's a real pleasure to be here. In an alternate universe, I might have been a lawyer. That would have been a universe where the internet had come a few years, or I had come a few years later, and where you could actually do all your legal research online. Libraries frightened me. Like, there were all these books that were really hard to read because I'm blind. So instead, I'm a technologist, and honestly, technology is a lot of fun anyway. And I work with Debian, and Debian is a community of, I guess, thousands of people. We have a formal organization, we have a constitution, and it even has legal existences, although it turns out that's different than the organization through a variety of complex jurisdictional reasons, because we're spread all across the world. And one of the biggest things Debian makes is an archive of like 50,000 packages of free software. And another thing we make is the Debian distribution. And actually, I'd say that these are slightly separate, because there are a lot of, I think that that one of the values that Debian brings is it brings a curated collection of software that we've reviewed the licensing of and that we've thought about how it works together. And what that means is that we start typically with an individual going and looking at a piece of software and reviewing the license, and typically they review it file by file. And look at whether it meets the Debian free software guidelines, which are very similar to the open source definition. We work very closely with them, which are related to the Free Software Foundation's Four Freedoms. And a person reviews the license and thinks about how it fits into the Debian ecosystem, and ultimately someone who's gone through our new membership process brings the software into Debian. And then it gets reviewed by another group of people who also do a license review. And I will admit that for certain large packages, like say the Linux kernel or Firefox or LibreOffice, I think that perhaps it is not reviewed file by file. There is some review that's done. But my understanding is that there are some, especially for organizations where we trust their upstream review and where their software is very large, we take a slightly different approach. But eventually, by the time software makes its way into Debian, multiple people have reviewed it and have said this software actually meets our definition of freedom. And not only is it itself free, but we've confirmed that it doesn't depend on any non-free components. Yes, as Professor Mogulyn pointed out in the opening remarks, we have succeeded in getting everyone interested in at least some of their software being free. We have not succeeded in getting everyone to agree that all of their software could be free. And people play some really interesting games with, oh, sure, you can get this part free. Of course, it's only useful on our commercial library that you have to pay for. Or, oh, sure, we'll be happy to have this infrastructure free so we can build services to lock you in on top of it. And sometimes that's great, and sometimes it isn't, and Debian has its particular compromises how we do that. But we give you, you know, over 50,000 packages that we've actually done that review on. The second thing we do is we take those packages into a stable distribution of Debian that comes out every couple of years, and it is a consistent set of those packages that work together, work reliably, and that move very slowly once the stable distribution is released. And it's kind of interesting that I mentioned both of those things separately because different groups of people care about different versions of that. Some people wish, you know, want that really stable version, but some people really actually value the fast-moving Debian that is just about the license review. And that's, for example, build a distribution on top of Debian that moves as fast as it can given that license review. One of the challenges we're facing is that there's so much free software being written these days that even doing that review and getting all the dependencies into Debian is enough work that some key packages we'd really love to have in the Debian ecosystem can't be there just because the manpower to get all the dependencies in and to get the license review done is more than we can handle. And so there are ways in which even the fast-moving side of Debian moves a little bit slower than some people want. That's kind of a brief introduction to where Debian is and where it is, you know, and what we bring to the world. I guess, you know, I mean, basically it's a volunteers all around the world. There's a membership process you can go through to become a voting member. There's a lot lighter weight process you can become to get packages into Debian. And an even lighter weight process to communicate to contribute to the community, suggest changes, work on bugs, participate in our discussions.
When we talk about Debian no longer just as the universal operating system, but the universal upstream, what we mean is that there are an awful lot of distributions that use Debian's review and packaging and dependency analysis to found their own, right?
Yep.
Linux Mint and Ubuntu and a whole lot of other things.
Kali, you know, a big one there. Kali is interesting because they are actually one of those really fast-moving ones. Like, they actually try and move as fast as they can, sometimes even faster than us.
And what do you want to be, Sam? Speaking for the Debian community as a whole, what do you want to be as a manufacturer or distributor of software?
So this is something where I think the Debian community is still trying to figure it out. And this is, in my keynote address at our annual conference, I started posing some of these questions. Things I know we want to be are, we want to drive free software in terms of user freedom forward. And we want to find a way to continue to be relevant in that way. I know that we continue, that our traditional stable releases are critically important to lots and lots of people. There, you know, even in this fast-paced world of the cloud, there are cases where you value stability. And in fact, you talked about a lot of those, you know, containers that are only going to be around for, you know, a few milliseconds. A lot of the Docker files that create on the server side, those containers, you know, start with a line that looks a lot like from Debian. Saying that they're going to start with Debian as a base. and even for some of their dependencies will pull it in. And so it's clear that what we've always been doing is still valuable. I think the interesting question is that we're still struggling with, and it's not the DPL's job to answer these questions, but more to pose them and to facilitate discussion. And the interesting question is, are there ways that we can better deal with the software that's, you know, so that's hard for us to bring into Debian? Are there ways that Debian can be a better tool for the world of user space containers? Can citizen in the world where there are language specific repositories? And the world of Flatpak and Snap, and basically all of these technologies that are trying to bring app store-like things to the free software world. And how can we do that while actively respecting user freedom, rather than just letting this be a way of bypassing user freedom and giving control to whoever's willing to throw a package out there on the internet? And I think that's the question we're trying to answer.
Richard, what is the informal sector like in that sense? What is the polar alternative to that process of file by file examination and license checking and stable distribution releases for years on end?
Well, so the basic problem that I see that I think is reflected in some of what Sam was talking about initially, is that there's been this growing gap. At least this is the point of view I think that some of us who kind of work close to Linux distributions, the way we see it, a gap between what developers want and what the makers of distributions want to create. So developers are, you know, increasingly impatient with the pace of distributions like Debian, or even faster paced ones like Fedora. Developers want, often want the latest versions of software. They want software that, let's assume it's free software or open source, but it is just not packaged in any distribution, and that's partly an issue of resources, as Sam was saying. As big a project as Debian is, it can't package everything. Fedora can't package everything. Red Hat Enterprise Linux can't package everything that developers currently want. There are, I don't even know how many, like the perhaps hundreds of thousands, maybe, of packages in certain popular languages that are not really adequately packaged in these traditional Linux distributions that grew up in the, you know, the 90s and the earlier 2000s. So developers want a kind of more flexible way of getting software. They want to create complex stacks that may have multiple versions of the same upstream code base. And so what developers want is something that looks a lot more informal in terms of how the stack is kind of created than the more sort of streamlined and disciplined sort of system that the distributions worked on creating for many years.
And in order to make the user space activities packageable, we have devised container formats which layer software on top of other software, which load the same binary in multiple versions through different layers in the same container. How do we know that there is complete and corresponding source code available for the correct binary that container actually executes when somebody picks it up and starts running it? How much administrative overhead of that kind will be consistent with the sort of fast-moving software that you're talking about?
So for some of them, it's pretty easy to know. I've actually seen some, you know, blog posts that talk about how to construct your continuous deployment pipeline for these kind of software stacks. And you end up having testing for that. You have, for example, there are bots on GitHub that will go out and look at your dependency stack and open merge requests whenever your dependencies are out of date. And if your test coverage is good enough, you can get that. And then other ways you can approach programmatically using automation, determining that there's source code and that it's all built. And so it is totally possible for a sufficiently motivated organization for a given software stack to do a version of that software stack that's excellent from a free software standpoint. And yet, it's also totally possible to go, gosh, I'll just throw this binary blob in here. And the answer is, if you're a developer of that stack, you might very well know that what you have is excellent. But the challenge that the reason I think that third-party mediaries like distributions or something evolved from them have a real place to play is because there are these people other than developers. We call them users. It's their freedom that matters. And right now, they don't necessarily know that some Docker image they're getting or some Python wheel that they're getting gives them all the freedom they want. They don't know that that an NPM package they're getting doesn't have a bug in its minified JavaScript that's going to go send their Bitcoin off somewhere they wish it didn't happen. That's a very real example that did in fact happen to an unfortunate package in that ecosystem. I think that's the interesting question is how to get this sort of fast-paced stuff, but also to give users guarantees about freedom.
Richard?
Yeah, so the problem that I see with respect to containers and specifically, you know, the need to have complete corresponding source code is that these systems for very conveniently and easily obtaining those layers you talked about grew up, were sort of designed and built by people, companies that were not primarily concerned with compliance. So this technology was popularized without source compliance or license compliance in general being a primary goal in mind. Whereas I think that one could say that the distributions like Debian and Fedora grew up with license compliance and an attention to legal detail as a primary objective, in addition to, you know, wanting to create conveniently consumable software. So there's a social and kind of cultural problem that grew up as containers became popularized through, you know, basically through Docker primarily initially. And so we're kind of you know, living through that now, and the distributions are you know, like RHEL and Fedora and Debian, they now have a kind of special new role to play in the containerized world because they there's an additional argument for why you should be getting, you know, building your container layers from stuff that is carefully sourced from you know, well-known distributions, which is that you can you should be able to find out, you know, where your layers come from, you know, what the packages were, you know, generated from, where the source code is. So that's you know, I hope that we are sort of transitioning from the sort of you know, Wild West kind of scenario that initially existed with some of these container registries towards a more a kind of like a marriage of the traditional distribution, GNU Linux distribution, with you know, the convenience of being able to create and then easily deploy containers.
Well, as Sam pointed out, right, that's because the user's rights were so important to the people making the distributions. They had a copyleft mindset, even when they weren't dealing with copylefted software. They were still thinking out of a mental framework in which it is the preservation of the user's rights, which is the raison d'etre for the way we handle the software, which isn't necessarily in tension with a developer's rights. I want to get my best software and put its best foot forward out into the world as quickly as possible. I am paid to make these workloads jump. But it's not necessarily consistent with that either. What Sam said and what you were picking up on is that we can have technical best practices for doing that. And Sam says Debian needs to learn to get a little faster in the sense that it needs to deal with forms of distribution like Flatpak and Snap that may allow us to speed developers' interests, but we're still going to have to figure out how to subject all of that to the user's rights perspective, which is fundamental to our reason for existing. And you said, we're getting better at that because the people who happened to build the technology first in the world of containerization and mobile workloads and ultimately cloud-native computing, they began from a perspective which didn't necessarily take users' rights as seriously as the traditional distributions. Do I have you correct?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
So if that's right, then one part of what we can do is technical, as Sam is saying. We can take comfort from the fact that our deep, warm friends and allies at Microsoft now own GitHub, and they can do wonderful things to help developers who use it, and they can create whole ranges of new autonomous processes for helping to cover these gaps. Are there things that we could do on the licensing side that would also help?
I think that's the big question, right? Is that I think, so it's not that Debian necessarily needs to move faster, for example, to work with Snap and Flatpak. It's that I think there's a community question of helping people understand the value of an intermediary. Basically, in some real senses, Fedora or Debian actually audit license compliance and audit supply chain issues so that audit some quality issues. And honestly, I think that even in a fast-paced world, that kind of auditing has value. And I think the interesting question is to figure out how to bring, using whatever technology you want, but figuring out how to bring that kind of third-party review into other processes in a way that preserves user freedom is, in my mind, one of the big open questions in kind of free software distribution today. And I don't have answers. I'd like to start a conversation. I'd like to figure out, basically, the one thing I've come up with is I think that having third parties in the mix helps.
So one thing about third parties in this context I'd like to say is, there are these other intermediaries that have grown up kind of around the same time as the Linux distributions, but some of them are sort of grew up later in time. They exist at a higher point in the kind of the stack or the universe of free software code that I am kind of visualizing. So these are the language-specific upstream packaging systems that are out there that are kind of standing in between, in many cases, the initial project, the original project, and the potentially a distribution like Debian or Fedora or RHEL downstream. So these are things like NPM or Maven Central,
PyPy,
exactly. Yeah. Now the problem is that these have grown up in part because of what I was saying earlier, that the distributions haven't been able to keep up with the demand for packaging more and more software and more and more versions of upstream software. But the folks who are kind of developing or maintaining those upstream parallel package management systems that are sort of language or platform specific don't have the same sort of tradition or culture of care about licensing, you might say obsession with licensing and the tendency to want to audit that we see in the distribution world. And so I think that the challenge is how to kind of transfer that sort of older distribution culture a little bit upstream to those language-specific or platform-specific package management systems.
So actually, I'd like to distinguish between two categories of intermediaries. I think you have intermediaries who are providing a platform that's effectively an unmoderated platform, like GitHub. And then you have intermediaries, like the distributions, that are actually kind of providing an auditing point. And I think a lot of the language-specific repositories look a lot closer to the first. Like they don't have a lot of requirements. I don't know a lot of people who have, who've had trouble getting their node package into NPM. And I'm not sure, I don't know their cultures very well, but I think that may be intentional. And I actually think the community is served by having places where you can find the everything. But I also think that finding a way for some of that second category of intermediary that does care about review might be valuable to the community.
We think that law affects culture and culture affects law, so I want to try and put a finer point back on the question. Are there ways that we can use licensing itself to help people acquire the right culture? It doesn't seem to me entirely adventitious that most of those language communities you talk about are not standardized around copyleft licensing. They like MITx and they like the Python license and they like other forms of licensing which are good for developers and highly flexible, but may not require the kind of attention to the preservation of users' rights that copyleft licensing has done. Is there a way that we can use licensing itself to cause the conversation within communities of programmers to become more conscious of the preservation of users' rights? Can we make copyleft simpler, or can we make permissive licensing more complex in some way that will help?
Do you have any specific examples?
Well, I'm talking also to Richard, who is a license maker and
sure.
Who might have ideas of his own about that. Have your thoughts gone there?
I don't think that making permissive licensing more complicated it doesn't strike me as being a viable approach for cultural reasons, because
Because many people use permissive licensing because they want to rock and roll.
Well, you said something very interesting, which is that these upstream intermediaries, the language specific intermediaries, they see, a lot of them at least seem to they tend to be mini universes of packages that look like they're more likely to be dominated by permissive licenses than copyleft licenses. I don't know how much to make of that, but I think that is connected in some way to the greater informality and the lower sort of adherence to a culture of careful concern for some of the niceties of license compliance. So this applies to the permissive license stuff as well. So there are some of these upstream packages that get put in these intermediaries. Something that I've seen from time to time is that the whoever is kind of uploading it, usually it's the original upstream project, but not always, will strip out license files, for example. This is something that happens, and that's regardless of whether it's governed by the MIT license or GPLv2 or what have you. But one common feature of almost all of these licenses, of course, is that bare minimum compliance. You have to preserve notice of what the original license was, and yet the packagers of the software are actually stripping those out to make the packages more streamlined and simpler. And we see that in the container world too. So how do you address that through licensing? I don't really have a good answer to that. I have thought that on the copyleft side, you know, this obviously becomes, the compliance becomes more acute, I think, in a sense than on the permissive license side, if only because the original licensors maybe this is kind of a copyleft bias, but they may care less about compliance ultimately compared to the copyleft licensor. But how do you use licensing to make sure that complete corresponding source code is available to the user? The only thing I can say is that maybe simplifying the requirements around what you do in that kind of situation to provide notice of where to get the source code is an answer. Like maybe there's a complexity to what the GPL, GPL v2 or GPL v3 seem to require or allow that could be made more flexible to facilitate situations where, for example, the source code is actually widely available, but it is often some other, distribution, or you can easily get it, but it's all public, but it's not going to be in this container registry necessarily. I'm not sure that that's really a satisfactory long-term solution, but that's one possibility.
My heart warms to it, but this may be the only room in the world where there will be people who will have questions about a conversation like this, and we should let them have them. People want in? Sam, you want to say something?
No. I mean, you've stuck us up here for people to throw fruit at us, in these high seats. I mean, if people aren't going to actually jump in, what's the point of all that?
I wanted to mention that the discussion about containerization actually even applies to end users now, containers which are not distributed at all. For example, prior to Debian Buster being released when I was still using Stretch, in order to use the most recent release of the certbot tool, you had to install it from PyPI. You couldn't use the Stretch version because it was missing features that everybody wanted. So you then use the Python mechanism virtualenv for those who care about that sort of thing to create an ad hoc container to install it into so you can get the most recent versions of the dependencies and not be stuck with the version that was available in the distribution. So this becomes even an issue just for end users, not just for people who are distributing things. The pace of the package development and release is so fast that I don't think any team of moderators could actually keep up with that.
And yet, the thing is that there are still people who value that moderation, right? That is the big challenge I think we're all facing. Is like, if we decided that license compliance and avoiding malware weren't important, the solution's simple. Unfortunately, we kind of like those things.
Hi. So I had a question because I know Debian recently instated that new packages have to be reproducible, and I think that is that true?
Go on with your question.
Well, this might be very naive, but do you guys foresee a world in which it is part of the license that not only do you have the source code, but that the binaries that are released are reproducible, and thus that the source code actually corresponds to the binaries that you're releasing?
So I'm trying to think about whether that would be DFSG free. That's fascinating. Wow.
It could be, because if you pass certain command arguments, you're going to get a
different. So, well, no, but I mean, if you did pass the same with the, like, would. Let's say that if your license said that you had to have a license that, or had to have binaries that were reproducible given, and you had to describe the build environment well enough that it was reproducible if you were going to distribute. That seems like an awful burden to make an individual user face before giving a copy of a binary to a friend, honestly. And yet, I'm not sure that it would be non-free in our standpoint. So to answer your specific question, Debian recently decided that we were not accepting binaries built on individual developers' machines. Reproducibility is something we're working towards, but it's something we value strongly, but it is not a requirement.
I just want to add that would seemingly proscribe the use of non-deterministic compilers. I think that would be effectively impossible without dramatically changing the landscape of developer tools.
We haven't.
No.
Not. It would not. Yes, it would limit some things. But if you take a look at the reproducible builds process or project, surprisingly few.
I think doesn't the GPL already require complete and correspondence?
Forgive me. Could you turn the microphone on in front of you? For a remote audience, the speak icon, touch that.
Ah.
There you go.
Thanks, apologies. Because the GPL requires complete and corresponding source code, it kind of is the mechanism that ensures that reproducible builds have a source code base to point to. So you kind of can't do this with proprietary software. So in a way, the freedom aspects of the GPL make reproducible builds possible. Because you have to have complete control over the not just the source code, but the tool chain.
Actually, there are proprietary systems that really do care about reproducibility. I mean,
how can you do that without the source code? Within their
environment, right? Mm-hmm. You can't prove it's reproducible, but within an environment where you have access to the source code, you can. And that is absolutely important to some people in the proprietary space and has been, in some ways, longer than it has been important to the free software community.
Go ahead, Jim. I really do want to know what Oracle thinks about this. This is important.
Oracle is not here today.
Uh-huh. But Jim Wright, speaking for himself, what does he think?
No, I mean, if your compiler just uses has a seed based on the build machine, right, a non-deterministic compiler makes this literally, theoretically not possible. So I think you would.
So and that's why.
Well, and I think what we've, so the reproducible builds community has said, we have found that the value of reproducible builds is such that we expect your compiler to be able to load a seed if it's going to have one. And the number of cases where we found that the value to a particular software package was high enough that we're willing to make an exception for the non-determinism is remarkably low.
I think we ought to understand that there are many different elements in the user's right to have the source code, at one end of the spectrum of which is the right to reproduce exactly the bytes in the binary from exactly the source code provided. But that's a particular view of the user's right at a particular moment. The primary user's right is to learn from the software, to know what the ideas are that the software represents, and to be able to use those ideas both in situ and to move those ideas somewhere else and instantiate them in other software inventions. For which purpose, after all, we never interpreted the GPL to say that you had to have an interpreter, for example, for the source code you were given. We always held that the GPL was satisfied if you got the source code of an interpreted program, even if you didn't have access to the interpreter that was running the particular binary. Because what we were preserving was the user's right to learn. That doesn't mean that in every circumstance that would be perfectly acceptable. And as Sam is pointing out, what really comes to bear is an exception condition. The general proposition is you need exactly the source code from which the thing was built, and enough of the scripts and tools that it is theoretically possible for a technically sophisticated person to build the binary received from the source code given. And as Sam said, if you want to have any control over malware, you pretty much have to have that much. Because if you can't actually be sure that the source code you have studied is the binary that's running, then the security consequences of the user's rights have vanished altogether. But there is some limit at which the question, whether it is the non-deterministic compiler or the presence of odd machine architectures for which we are maintaining code museums.
Or signatures, right? I mean, I don't necessarily, with the consumer provision of the GPL3 notwithstanding, there are many licenses, even copyleft licenses, that don't actually guarantee that I'm able to produce a signed binary.
Yes. And only some circumstances, even under GPL3, yep, in which that ability to produce a signed binary is relevant. McCoy will remember how much time we spent, yes, on that little matter. So let us ask then just one last question. Which part of this friction over trust, because it is a friction over trust, who do we trust to make the software? What do we trust them to have checked? How do we choose to rely on people? Which part of this trust friction is the part we're trying to preserve? And which part is the part we would like to get rid of in order to make things easier for people? From my point of view, the compromises represented by GPL2 and GPL3 are still basically 20th century compromises. We need source code to be available in files you can get on media usually used for software exchange. And we loosened that in GPL3 in ways that we thought were appropriate to the first decade of the 21st century, but may not be appropriate to the second or the third. Are we imposing in our most user-respecting licenses frictions that we ought now to be considering lifting? Are there ways to simplify copyleft which will produce a better cultural compromise? More respect for users' rights in return for more ease of application and deployment for programmers who want, for perfectly legitimate reasons, technical and economic, to move as fast as they can, and to deliver, as you point out, as lightly as they can, as small, as fast, as minified, as easy for the user to run on the great big utility computing platforms of now. Sure, are there things we should be lifting? Restrictions we should be getting rid of?
I don't think so. Unfortunately, I think that if you actually want those user freedoms, you kind of need all those things. Like, the problems with GPL compliance are like actually checking things that kind of do matter, like, do you actually have source code to the dependencies? Did you actually provide the build scripts? And you can talk about how nice it would be to lift those, except like the users kind of do care. I'll say that, you know, an area where we could make things easier for people who choose to use the AGPL, enforcing this sort of, like, managing to distribute the right version of the source code of an AGPL work if you've made changes is actually really hard for most works. But in most other areas, if we actually care about these freedoms, I think the restrictions are still important.
Anybody else want to talk about this? I think this is a big conversation for the future. Maybe we are done with it today. Richard, you want a last word?
Yeah, I mean, I just think that the overall policies that are implemented in the licenses we have today are appropriate. I don't think that means that we have to have, for example, the set of allowed modes of distributing corresponding source code that GPLv3 authorizes. There could be various relaxations of it. This is part of what I guess was envisioned by the possibility of additional permissions. But I think the direction we should probably be going in, if we think about simplifying copyleft, is pointing to those kinds of simplifications. So making it easier, not more difficult, for developers, providers of packaged images, to comply with source code requirements and other free software license requirements, rather than imposing a stricter regime than we currently have.
completely agree. And let us leave it there for at least a couple of hours. Thank you very much.